candidates for President of the United States have discovered, and this has been borne out by recent nationwide polls, after the general malaise the economy is suffering from right now, the top worry that people in the United States have concerns health care. People are openly afraid of getting sick. And in a country with some of the finest technical and medical facilities in the world, illness is often linked with impending poverty. It costs money to get well. And in Alaska, there is a problem. Surveys done in 1989 show that some 15%, that's approximately one in six Alaskans, have no health care insurance. At that same time, health care costs had increased from 111% during the 80s, from about $1,200 a year to more than $2,500 a year per person. And Alaska's costs were more than a third above the national average. It may give credence to some of those who point out that the last frontier is still a frontier. Senator Jim Duncan of Juneau has been active nationally in the search for a solution to the health care dilemma. He's introduced legislation this year that would make universal health care possible in Alaska, and he's with us this morning. Welcome, Senator.
Thank you, Dave. Pleasure to be here.
Also with us today, Joe Hyacin is vice president with Shattuck and Grommet Insurance in Juneau. He's the legislative chairman for the State Life Underwriters Association. Mr. Hyacin is a specialist in health insurance and represents the insurance industry. The legislature's Health Resources and Access Task Force met this week. Over the weekend, they finished the work on looking for a consensus on the state's involvement of how the state can be involved in health care. They agreed on a concept, at least in principle, as I understand it. Senator Duncan, you were co-chair of that task force. Perhaps you could give us a brief description of where it is right now. What does this plan do?
Okay, thanks. I'll try to do that. And we have been meeting. That task force has been working pretty diligently over the past few months. In fact, since the beginning of the legislative session, we've met every other weekend trying to come up with some recommendations. We think we have done that, and we've built, we believe, consensus on the task force, which is a very diverse task force. It's got not only legislators and administration members, but members of the private sector, public nonprofits. The insurance industry has a member on it. Providers, both hospitals and doctors, were there, and we got consensus, we believe, from the task force. That doesn't imply, of course, that everyone that those individuals represent will necessarily agree, but we hope we've made a step forward. And there's several major, instead of using the term concepts, although I've used that myself in the past, I think it's more appropriate to say several components of a comprehensive health care reform that we've adopted at this point from the task force view and are recommending legislative action on. And just very briefly, let me run through those, and we'll probably want to discuss them in more detail. But one would be to establish a single entity that would oversee this whole area of health care reform, and that would include the data gathering, putting together the data systems that are necessary to really identify where we are, what the problem is, how much is being spent where, and why. We need that kind of base foundation, very specific first. Secondly, then, in the area of cost containment, because you have to both try to control the cost as well as increase access. In the area of cost containment, the recommendation is to control the health care cost by establishing a global spending limit for all health care expenditures in Alaska, and then underneath that, a reimbursement system for all health care payers. And that's a pretty bold step. It's not been done in other states yet, a global spending limit. It's being talked about by some other states. It's being talked about on a national level, establishing a national global spending limit for health care expenditures. But this task force has gone on record as recommending that we take that bold step, and I think a very progressive step, and try to do it this legislative session. Secondly, or third, then, we recommended increased access by doing several things. One, reforming the small group insurance market. I'm sure Mr. Hyacin can speak better to that than I can, what that means and how he thinks that impacts. But there seems to be some agreement that we need to reform the small group insurance market, give this entity the ability to create pools to bring individuals together or groups together to procure insurance, and to begin the access package by providing subsidies to certain uninsured individuals in this state. And we identified as our top priority low-income children and low-income pregnant women. And secondly, to begin bringing the high-risk individuals into it by establishing high-risk pools. Another step would be to try to pass legislation, take some steps to help reduce malpractice costs. That's high on the provider community's list of things that need to be done to control health care costs, and we've put a couple proposals forward which we're hopeful we'll be able to move with. And then finally, to try to reduce or control the excess capacity in the state of facilities through revision and strengthening of our Certificate of Need program. So as you can see, there's a number of components there. I think it's pretty broad, wide-ranging, and a comprehensive approach.
Okay. That pretty well sets the plan out there. We want to hear from you, our listeners, this morning. Our number is 1-800-478-TALK. That's 1-800-478-8255. Give us a call. Let's hear what you have to say about health care insurance, and Alaska's involvement in it, what the state can do. Mr. Hyacin, question. The center has presented this plan. The insurance industry did have representatives on the task force. In general, what's the response from the insurers?
Well, for openers, you have to understand that I'm not talking from the standpoint of the insurance companies. I'm talking for the insurance agents and brokers. And there are actually some issues that we don't even agree with the insurance companies on. So there's one more area to be heard from. We commend Senator Duncan and his task force and his personal legislative efforts to get some reform going in the state to address some of the problems that are going on, particularly from the standpoint of access and cost containment. And while we don't agree on every point as to how it should be done and what vehicles would be most appropriate, I think we're all going in the same direction. And at least it's a start. That's the main thing. I just came back from a legislative forum in Washington, D.C., where members from every state were there, and we went and we talked to the congressman and to some people on Capitol Hill about the problem, and quite frankly, there's not even a consensus on Capitol Hill as to what the problem is. Mm-hmm. It's a fun thing to talk about during the election years, but in reality, there are not that many people with a solution in Washington, D.C., and they're actually looking to it. They're kind of hoping to, that the states are going to come up with something. So I think in Alaska, we're going in the right direction here, taking the lead and taking the bull by the horns and addressing these things and trying to come up with some way to make it all happen.
Okay. I want to follow up on that question. First of all, our number here is 1-800-478-TALK, 1-800-478-8255. The subject is health care insurance, and the state of Alaska. You had been to several national meetings. I know, Senator, also that you have been involved in a lot of national work that's been done. So far, the only state that I'm aware of that has done anything on sort of a state plan has been Oregon. That has actually passed legislation. It's a different type of a system from the one that you're recommending here. The first thought is, why has no one else come up with something?
Well, I think the reason no one else has come up with something is it is a very complex problem, and there is no easy solution. And no matter what you do in the area of health care reform, you're going to be touching some group and perhaps changing the way they do business or the way they interact. And that means not just the insurance industry. It means the provider communities, and it also means consumers, we as consumers. If we're really going to reform the health care system and slow down the inflationary spiral and make health care more accessible, not only do you involve the insurance industry and the provider community in that, but consumers have to change the way they shop and the way they do business with health care. It's become real easy for many of us because we have adequate health care insurance just to pop into the doctor's office or the emergency room whenever we need to, and utilization keeps going up and up. And as utilization gets out of control or is not not well controlled, costs rise. So the reason why it hasn't been done, because everybody's impacted, it's complex, there's no easy solution. But we're trying in Alaska, as I said, to bring together the groups and work forward with some consensus, and it's one step at a time. And let me tell you that even if we got all this through this year, the job's not done. We'd have to keep moving forward.
Okay. Joe, you mentioned also the fact that the federal government is sort of wishing the states would take on this thing and it wouldn't become a federal problem, at least that's as I understood it. But apparently the federal government is involved in it. The change in state procedures requires changes or exemptions on Medicaid benefits and various other federal programs that are involved there, and that requires congressional action as well. And bureaucratic administration action as well. Is that a problem that can be resolved, or is the federal government actually throwing up roadblocks to some of this, or are they encouraging it that some of these changes be made?
The federal government is actually a cause of some of this, naturally, through they created Medicaid and Medicare for the elderly and Medicaid for the poor. Mm-hmm. And they set up the programs and then promptly underfunded them. And They're under tight budgetary constraints in Washington, of course, and when they're backing down on the funding of these large programs, these are Medicaid and Medicare large programs, by underfunding them, then we come up with this monster called cost shifting, where you have the providers and hospitals and doctors and things like that that are not being funded as well through Medicare and Medicaid as they were before, so they shift the cost over to their other patients or the other receivers of this medical care. It's called cost shifting. And you hear so much about this, about unfunded care and non-reimbursed care that hospitals have to put out. Well, that's a form of what you call cost sharing, because the provider has a certain nut to crack financially. And if they're going to be shorted on one side, then they're going to make it up on the other side. And the part of the problem that we see is that it gets shifts over to the private sector and the employers.
Okay, our number, 1-800-478-8255. Our caller is from Juneau. Juno, good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. My name is Fisher, and I'm a local resident and have had experience with the matter about which I'm going to inquire. In about 20 years ago, one of those roving medical teams picked up the fact that I had a spot on my lung, and I underwent treatment for tuberculosis. It's my understanding that tuberculosis is again surging in incidence in Alaska, and I was wondering how the proposed health care changes would take care of a person who would be, like myself, an urban person and who might not be covered by medical insurance. How would such an illness be handled under the proposed care proposals that have been reported out by this health care task force?
Let me ask a question of you, Mr. Fisher. Have you been determined to be uninsurable for that particular reason? Is that a problem there?
No, that wouldn't be a problem because that would not be a problem because, of course, tuberculosis is treatable and is treatable on an outpatient basis. The illness, and one of the reasons I picked the illness as an example is because it is and has been such a terrible problem in Alaska, and it is now making another surge. And recently, the Newsweek magazine had a whole section on the problems that were occurring with tuberculosis across the country.
Okay, so what is your question?
My question is, how would a person who would have tuberculosis, who might not be insured, how would the proposed health care system that is come up with or proposals by the task force take care of such a person who needed treatment?
Senator?
Okay, well, let me just try to answer that question in two ways, and it may not just overnight take care of the problem, Mr. Fisher, but it's designed to address the problem of the people who are uninsured, and that's what we're trying to get to. First, through trying to slow down the inflationary spiral, and secondly, then, through doing small market insurance reform and creating methods of accessing the system for those individuals who aren't insured. For example, and you may not be, as from what I understand, but if you're in a high-risk group, we are recommending establishment of a high-risk pool, which would require which would be set up so that those individuals who are in a high-risk category could obtain health insurance coverage. If you are in a low-income group, for example, you may finally end up in a subsidized program if that's what we determine is the best. But it's through the cost containment features through pooling and other access steps that are being taken that at some point we hope to bring you as an uninsured individual into the system. What we have, of course, also determined is that one of the ways, and you mentioned it at the outset of your question, that the problem of TB is increasing in Alaska. That, I think, is a very basic problem with our healthcare system, is that we aren't getting people into the system early enough, and so we're designing it immediately to have preventive care for people. That's probably the basic plan that would be put together. We have not recommended plans in this, what type of basic health care plan there would be, but we're putting together the entity, the structure, to ensure that uninsured people do get into the system. So, again, it may not be overnight, but we're trying to take the steps that will bring you into that system. And if you can afford it on your own, then you would be just accessing the system on your own. At some point, if you're a low-income individual, you might receive some type of subsidy.
And may I just follow that up with one more question? Is my understanding the proposals are emphasizing the preventative rather than the attempts to correct or cure?
Well, we're not, again, I want to make it very clear, we did not put together a basic health plan that should be in the state of Alaska. We aren't designing a basic health plan. We're going to leave the plan design up but to individuals, for the most part, is the type of plan they want to have and that they should access. But we have gone on record as a task force saying that the first thing that we should be emphasizing, of course, one is preventive care. That's the top priority for preventive care. But secondly, we want to be sure that high-risk individuals or individuals who have a pre-existing condition or for some other reason haven't been able to access the market, and we're proposing to do that through small market insurance reform and other access steps.
Joan, you had anything you want to add to that? The industry, does the industry like that approach to things?
Oh, yes, we do. You know, as a broker and an agent, we have a tough time placing some of these people that are high risk or uninsurable, and the insurance companies just don't want to have anything to do with them, and we don't have a big enough market up here where we can beat the insurance companies up and force them to take it. So by putting some sort of a high-risk pool together, we've got some place where we can write insurance for these people and put them in.
Okay. Our number is 1-800-478-TALK, 478-8255. Our next caller is from Anchorage. Anchorage, good morning.
Hello. Yes, this is Tim Feller with the Green Party of Alaska, and we have been relatively supportive of Senator Duncan's bill, SB 83, but I'm very concerned about many of the changes I see put into it as it goes through committee, and I'm also very concerned about the recommendations of the task force, and I'd like to address some of those to Mr. Duncan, if I could.
All right, let's clarify one thing. Senator, it hadn't gone through committee at all yet, has it?
Well, Senate Bill 83 has gone through one committee, and okay. It was changed from what I originally introduced it, and undoubtedly it'll be changed again, but I'm pleased to have your comments.
Well, as I understood, originally this bill would have pooled all the state, borough, municipal, school, judicial workers, retired and active together. And this specific clause seems to have been dropped from the current SB 83.
Well, it's still in the current SB 83 that's before the Senate Hess Committee. However, in the committee substitute that will be proposed to the Hess Committee in the near future, specific reference to pooling of any specific groups will be dropped. But let me emphasize that we are still maintaining that concept. And what we're doing is, instead of specifically saying certain groups will be pooled together, we're putting into SB 83 the cost containment steps, which is the global spending limit. And I can explain that in more detail at a later time if you'd like. To explain how that works, but the global spending limit, and that spending limit will apply to all health care expenditures in the state of Alaska. And then we're giving this entity the ability to pool together groups of people for the purpose of either procurement or providing insurance. And the purpose of that pooling, of course, is to maximize savings by dealing with larger groups or pooling together groups that haven't been accessed before, but to realize the benefits of larger group purchase of insurance.
Well, may I just say, I'll just leave you with this comment, and perhaps you can address it. Our feeling is that unless we develop a single-payer, single-tiered, comprehensive system, universal access system, like that which is known throughout Canada and the provinces, and like that which is known throughout most of the developed and civilized world, what you will in effect do, if you don't do this, you'll create another bureaucratic level that, far from controlling costs, will exacerbate costs, will continue with cost transfers and will continue to disenfranchise people. And so how would you address that if you don't introduce community rating as a step to this, and if you don't introduce or basically head for the goal of a single-payer, single-tier system? How will your bill address the problems that might arise from what is presently being suggested by the task force? And I'll leave you with that question.
Okay, and I think that's a very good question. I do appreciate it. And let me say at the outset, of course, the problem you have, as I said earlier, with health care reform is very complex. It's not easy to do everything all at once. I think where I want to end up in the long term is something like that, a single-payer system, and that's where I was originally with Senate Bill 83. But as you work through the process, sometimes you can't do everything in the first big bite, so we're trying to step into this process and get things in place that will slow down the inflationary spiral, and our goal is to slow it down from the 15 to 20% we now have to a CPI increase, and consider any other factors that might impact that either negatively or positively, but to slow that increase down, and then provide the mechanisms to be sure that a large number of the uninsured people out there can access. And right now, at least the figures I have, there's about 40,000 uninsured individuals in the state who are at 250% or above of poverty level, and that those individuals with proper small market reform and proper pooling arrangements and other access steps taken probably can get into the system and help themselves if we really take the proper steps. You mentioned community rating, or the caller mentioned community rating, and it's very specific in our report to the legislature that that's an area that we are very much interested in and that we supported. The task force went on record as supporting the concept of community rating. And what we recommended, because it's a very complex area, we didn't take an initial step into that, but we recommended that the authority or the commission that we're establishing here identify the effects of mandating community rating for all private groups, as well as any pools that would be created by the authority or the commission, and report that back to the legislature with their findings and their recommendations within 1 year of the creation of the authority. And the reason why we did that is because that's a complex area. It's very, I think, probably will be very beneficial and something we should do, but we couldn't probably in this short period of time, this session, understand that well enough to get it through the legislative process. And so we're establishing the authority, which will have some people with some expertise and background and have the time to do it, and are asking them to come back to us with what steps should then be taken in order to get us to community rating, what are the benefits, what are the downsides, and so on, so that we can make a very informed decision in the legislature. And also, we support the concept of minimizing medical underwriting and also ask the entity to take a look at that. So I appreciate your call and understand your concerns, and I think we're moving to that point. It's going to take a little time to get there, but we're much further ahead than where we were a year ago, I think.
Joe, the caller mentioned something here concerning that in many ways the state is setting up a new bureaucracy. I think that was the phrase that the caller used. Is this an accurate description also that we're putting up a level here of management somewhere that just may in some ways get in the way of private industry that could take care of something?
Well, of course, yes. We feel that the system can best be addressed by the current market-driven system, which, incidentally, is covering 85% of the people quite successfully now, mm-hmm. and even though it is a little on the expensive side, and it's probably one of the reasons that we have such good medical care available and the degree of high tech that we've got, as opposed to a single-payer system, i.e. government, the Canadian-type system. I could tell you horror stories about the Canadian system, and the Canadians could tell you horror stories about how long it takes to get into their system. So there's some definite drawbacks to that sort of thing. We basically embrace the concept of a combination of private-public entities putting together the best that each of those sides has to offer in addressing some of the issues and maintaining the coverage.
Okay. Our next caller at 800-478-8255 is from Anchorage. Anchorage, good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. This is Jim Green, and my question is sort of a philosophical one, I guess. My concern with a lot of these reforms is that people begin to become more dependent on the government. They look to the government to solve a lot of these problems, and this goes for more than just health care, but health care, what incentive people have to take responsibility for their own health and keeping their own health costs down if the government's going to take a lot of that responsibility from them?
Joe?
I agree with you. Part of the problem, and I think a very large part of the problem, is the concept of that people have of that is not their responsibility anymore. The third-party administrator and the insurance companies have got in the way and in between the doctor and the patient. Who's going to pay for this, or whether it's government or an insurance company, is what the big issue is, and the poor patient is lost. The average person, including myself, doesn't go to the doctor's office anymore and ask ahead of time, what's this going to cost? I haven't the foggiest idea what my dentist is going to charge me when I go sit down in the chair, because I have insurance. So there is no incentive for me to do this. If I have a personal financial risk involved in the form of deductibles or co-insurance or having to pay something out of my pocket, I'm going to want to know in advance how much they're going to charge, and I'm going to have a little discussion with that doctor about what tests he's going to do and what tests he's not going to do, and with a probable outcome. But at this point, with good group insurance, as we have for many people in the state of Alaska, no one cares. It's kind of a blank check approach, and that's one of the major problems. We need to get the consumer or the patient interested in what's going on.
Senator?
Well, just a very, very brief response on that. The one thing that we're trying not to do is to get the state involved into great depth and detail and make it a government-run program. And I think we're trying to structure our legislation very carefully to keep the market forces involved as much as possible. And that's why, you know, as I said just a few moments ago, I think with proper small market insurance reform, with proper cost controls in place and proper other access steps, that a large portion of the uninsured Alaskans, about 38,000 of them, can probably help themselves without any state assistance. Well, I'm not recommending that we immediately put together a program where everybody has their health care costs partially subsidized or partially paid for. I think we should be encouraging those who can help themselves to help themselves and get into the system on their own, and I think they will. And because I think that many of those people who aren't in the system like that right now would love to have health care coverage. They need it. They want it. And they, if they could get into the system and be assured that their costs weren't going to, their premiums weren't going to inflate by 30% a year, or if once they used the policy, they were dropped because they now have a condition that the insurance industry doesn't want to cover, I think they would stay in the system. I think it does mean that people may have to and will have to. We're not designing plans in this legislation. We're going to, you know, that's up to individuals. But I think you will find people's co-payments and deductibles changing perhaps as we go through this system. But, you know, you don't solve the problem by just shifting the cost from the employer to the employee. Cost shifting doesn't resolve the problem. You've got to help. You've got to control the problem. But so I think you will see some of that going on. People will be expected to participate. The other side of this equation that I haven't even mentioned, which is complex also, is not just, you know, how much is going to be expended, but utilization, how health care is going to be utilized. And one of the charges of this authority is to determine utilization standards, and that's volume. That's how much. And that also is what's increasing health care costs. And once you've determined utilization, that impacts the consumers also. So it's a complex issue. It's difficult to explain very briefly, but we're trying not to get government, deeply involved in it, but more than just to make the access.
You mentioned something a little while ago, and think that this may be, and I correct me because it's a point that I'm not real clear on. But you referred to the global spending limit, and it seems like we may be touching this idea, and yet again we may not. But what does that phrase mean? What are we talking about there?
Well, global spending limit means how much will be spent on health care, total health care expenditures in the state of Alaska. In the year 1989, this estimated figure is about $1.5 billion was spent on health care in the state of Alaska, not just spent by the state government, but everyone, private, public payers, spent $1.5 billion in the state of Alaska. If you let that grow uncontrolled at the inflationary rate of 15 to 20%, let's say 20%, you're going to have $10 billion by the year 2000. Well, what we're saying is that we should take that base year of 1991, for example, where the spending of healthcare expenditures in the state of Alaska was $1.5 billion, and try to slow down that growth. And the goal of this authority and the recommendations adopted by the task force was to take that base year as the amount of health care expenditures that should be allowed in the state of Alaska and inflate that by consumer price index increases, plus if there's other factors that are impacting it either negatively or positively to do that. So you've got the total of, say, $1.5 billion total health care expenditures in the state of Alaska. We can identify how much of that is being spent in hospitals right now, how much is being spent in physicians' offices, how much in dentists, and et cetera. And so you have subgroups underneath the global spending limit, and they have their goal or target for total spending also, they then would stay underneath that cap. And from what we've seen and be able to look at and the research we've done on it, that is a very, very possible or very plausible solution, and it can work.
So the idea here is that if a hospital is charging, I honestly don't know the rates now, but say X amount of money for a day's stay at a hospital, a normal treatment, that's the way it's figured, I understand, and the hospital needed or wanted to increase its rates by 15%. The authority would have the ability to say, we're not going to pay that, or to stop it, or where would the limit and how would it limit?
Well, for the hospitals, for example, the $1.5 billion, let's just make it easy. Let's say $500 million of that, a third of it spent in hospitals. Well, that would be the global spending limit. That would be the spending limit for hospital services. Now, how you would charge underneath that really is not my concern, that's not what I'm really concerned about. It's whether or not you allow that, whether you exceed that limit and how greatly you exceed it. So how they would break down their charges and how much each hospital would charge for certain stays per day or whatever, that would be negotiated with the commission, with the authority, in order to maintain total expenditures underneath that global limit. So it would be a negotiation process between probably an association representing the hospitals and the authority. And that may mean that different hospitals charge different things for different services. But that's fine. That's not the problem. It's just that you would then have some control over the total growth and slow it down from and maybe hospitals aren't growing at this amount, so I don't mean to imply they are, but slow down the growth from 15% a year to consumer price index increases. Mm-hmm. So there would be a negotiation process, and that's what we're trying to work towards, where we get the hospitals or the providers working cooperatively with the authority to negotiate how they're going to stay under that total expenditure limit.
Okay. Joe, does this idea of keeping expenditures down, keeping the expense down, doesn't the insurance company or does the insurance company interest itself in that right now?
Oh, yes. We endorse the concept because the higher the medical care costs are, the higher the insurance premiums to cover those are going to be, and the more distressed our insured persons are going to be for having to pay those kind of high premiums. So we hear about it every single day.
Yeah.
And we very actively have programs within the industry that we promote to our clients and to employers and individuals, cost containment strategies and that sort of thing to help keep utilization down and the amount that they would have to pay. That's only a small fraction of it, however. I mean, we can redesign plans and we can make all kinds of changes in the plan, but it is only going to affect at best maybe 15% of this total equation of the inflation in medical care costs.
Where's the rest coming from? I mean,
well, there are a number of players involved, and in going up and listening to the senator's task force up there, I shouldn't say the senator's task force, but he is a co-chair, there's a lot of people pointing fingers at each other. It's kind of a big round circle, you see. We point fingers at the providers and the doctors by saying that they're charging too much. And the doctors turn right around and say, well, we have to charge a lot because we're taking a lot of extra tests because we're worried about malpractice, and the cost of our malpractice insurance is maybe $100,000 a year for an obstetrician. And therefore, we're practicing defensive medicine, and it's costing us more money to do that. And then we point the finger at the bureaucracy in the federal government because of cost shifting. And then they turn right around and point the finger back at the insurance industry saying there's needless waste and there's too much administration going on, and then everyone points their fingers at the attorneys because they're dragging everybody into court over malpractice issues and outcome issues and a couple other things like that. So you have a lot of players involved in this situation, all pointing the finger at somebody else. It's sort of whose ox is going to get gored. And I think the final solution for this, is, as the senator has alluded to, is that everybody's going to have to make some changes, starting with the consumer, the payers, the insurance companies, the government, the attorneys, and the providers. Everyone's going to have to give a little.
Okay. Our next caller is from Eagle River. Eagle River, good morning. You're on the air.
Hello. My name is Karen Ruth. And did I understand you to say that you felt that 1 in 6 were not adequately covered by health insurance? Was that the figure you stated?
The figure that I had gotten was that there was 15% of Alaskans have no health insurance.
Okay.
And that's about 1 in 6, somewhere close to that figure.
Okay. My personal observation, I'm not a statistician or anything like that, but my observation is that that figure grossly understates a problem. I believe the figure is much higher. If you, I think that you should consider, as you go around town and you eat in a restaurant and you shop in a grocery store and you go to a gas station and look at the people in jobs that pay anywhere from $5, $6, $7, $8 an hour, jobs that are enough to pay your very basic expenses for living, but not really enough to put away any kind of money on. And there are very large, due to our economy, there are a very large amount of people like that. I think you look at your average cannery worker, there are many people that are not welfare recipients, but they barely make enough to get along.
What's called the working poor sometimes, perhaps.
Exactly. And many of these people do not want to be welfare people. I also heard you early in your discussion make a reference to women with small children. I believe this group is an important group, too. But I also want to make a point that this group has been helped by the welfare program. I do know women personally who have stayed on welfare longer than they might have normally stayed on because of the health benefits.
Let's take these one at a time. Oh, sure, go ahead. Sure, go ahead. I'm sorry, sure.
What I'm trying to state is I feel like I want you to look at these people as you go through the town and go through, you know, and look at these store clerks and whatnot. These people are either underinsured or they're not insured. One of the first places, I know I used to work for Sears and Roebuck here in Anchorage, and one of the first places a company will cut back when it's trying to economize and reorganize is a health care plan. They cut some of their health care benefits. It was also necessary to wait a full year to even get on that program. I think that you need to look at the fact that if something happens where if you break a leg or whatnot and you don't have workman's comp to cover you, and in many cases that's not adequate, you can get evicted from your apartment. You can lose your car if you're making car payments. And basically, your house of cards kind of collapses.
Okay.
And I think for the average person that believes in working for a living, who's not on welfare, who's not on food stamps, I think this is appalling. What's more, I think one of the reasons I called in was I talked to a man sitting here at the North Slope Cafe here in Eagle River yesterday who was going stateside after his wife died. He had to get a dissolution of marriage from a wife that he had been married to for over 40 years in order to get her the Medicare benefits she needed to cope with her cancer.
Okay, let's get some of these right at the time here. We're getting a lot of different points that you're bringing up here, and I'm respecting them. The senator is also, I think, Senator. It's a problem. I mean, uninsured, underinsured, and uninsured.
I appreciate the call, and I think she's very well laid out the problem that we're facing in the state of Alaska. I think she's done a good job of indicating that there is a problem out there, and that's what we're trying to address. The figure of 90,000 that we used is a figure that we have for uninsured Alaskans. That's been done by a couple of national studies. You're right. There's a greater number of people on top of that who are underinsured. We don't have the final figures or the final statistics, but that's what we're going to be getting in the next year once we get this authority in place. And we're trying to address the very problems that you talked about. The gentleman whose wife has cancer, for example, I'm not sure why they can't get insurance, but maybe it's a pre-existing condition that they can't get insurance, and so they might fit into a high-risk pool. Or the other people who, firms are dropping insurance when they have to cut back, they're dropping insurance. We're trying to put into steps, or put into place steps that would bring about some type of cost containment to slow down the inflationary spiral on premiums and to ensure that small businesses can continue to access the market. I have a letter in my packet. I just got it 2 days ago from a small company here in Juneau, insured through a much larger entity, but their premiums have gone up for the past 2 years 30% a year. Put them in a position where they've got to do one of two things, drop their coverage or tell their employees that they're going to get less benefits. So it's a very serious problem. I'm in complete agreement. We're trying to address many of those items that you mentioned.
This is Joe. Hi, Eisen. What you've put out here is a great philosophical question that needs to be addressed somewhere along the line is who needs insurance, how much insurance, and who's going to pay for it? The industry, we don't entirely agree with the figure of 90,000 uninsured Alaskans. We think that may be inflated ever so slightly, but nevertheless, there are a large number of uninsured and underinsured Alaskans. A whole lot of them are that way because they want to be that way. They're what the doctors call the immortals. They're the same people that don't bother to buy car insurance because it's too expensive, and you don't get to take anything home new when you pay insurance premiums. It's a really dull subject.
But they see doctors.
Oh, yes. Knowing full well that somebody, some deep pocket somewhere, is going to pay for it. And that's part of the problem, is this non-reimbursed care. We feel very definitely that maybe a large deductible or a basic core plan that is made available on a state basis or through a pool or anything else like that for all Alaskans that is affordable, that will they'll take the pressure off these large items, is something that may be worthwhile to look at.
I just wanted to clarify, when Joe said we, he meant the insurance industry, I guess, because I'm not convinced, this is Jim Duncan, I'm not convinced a large deductible does anything except stop people from getting very basic preventive care and in the long term increase your cost, because when they finally access the system, it's a major problem and it costs a lot of money. So there's a legitimate disagreement on that. And of course, the question is, at what level do they start doing that? It's like, a bus fare. If you have to pay 50 cents, everybody rides a bus. If you increase it to a buck, certain people don't because it's too expensive. So you've got to try to find that level.
Yeah, somewhere along the line, I guess the decision needs to be made is that a basic right to have health care, and if that is the case, who is going to pay for it? If the government is going to provide it is one thing, or if it's going to be mandated that everyone will have it and through tax breaks or your own pocket you're going to pay for it, but that's a pretty basic decision.
Okay. Our next caller is from Juneau. Juneau, good morning. You're on the air.
Yeah, I've got two questions. One is, how do you plan to deliver the preventive and maintenance care that you mentioned earlier in the program to the Bush? And the other one is, how are you going to pool Bush residents? The transportation costs are going to, of course, inflate their costs for both of these subjects quite a bit.
It's some good questions. A lot of health care services are not available statewide. I understand there's a problem with even childbirth in Juneau here. I've been told of that.
Well, there, you know, it is a good question, and there are a lot of problems with delivery of health care services in the state of Alaska. We're a pretty unique state. We're big geographically, where you got some remote areas, and there are places where there's not medical services. The answer to the question specifically to the gentleman is we don't have that plan in this legislation, but it's a very basic plan. A very basic problem is how do you be sure that the rural residents of this state have access to quality care? A lot of them may be on a subsistence economy. They're not in a cash economy, so they can't afford a very basic plan. So that may be the area of the state where you finally have to put together some type of an assistance program to ensure that they have a very basic preventive health care plan that they can access, that they can access and use for preventive care. May not pool those individuals together, and we're not saying that everybody's going to be pooled into a pooling group for purchase or procurement or providing of insurance, but that this authority would identify the groups that should be pooled to better access and to see if it would make health care more available to them. But the basic problem really is how do you get the health care services out to rural Alaska? And we've also talked about that on the task force. We don't have a solution yet, but steps that we could take to encourage medical professionals to locate in smaller communities and in rural Alaska, encourage them to do that. That's an area that needs to be looked at. Everybody's bringing up good questions. Unfortunately, we can't solve everything overnight.
Okay. Our next caller is from Anchorage. Anchorage, good morning.
Is this me?
Yes, you're on the air.
Okay, I was just wondering if their priority in this bill was to contain costs or to kind of pay with tax money what many people can't afford individually. As long as health care costs are rising faster than inflation, it seems to me that it has to ultimately be less affordable, regardless of how it's funded.
If I could ask, this is Jim Duncan again, sure. If I could answer that very quickly, and then maybe if there's further explanation needed, I'm glad to respond to that. The goal is to do two things. One is to control the inflationary spiral of health care costs. I agree with you. If health care costs, if the medical CPI is much greater than the normal consumer price index, and the goal of this bill, of this task force recommendations, is to slow down the inflationary spiral of health care costs in the state from the 15 to 20% that we've been seeing, to consumer price index, federal consumer price index increases. If we can do that, of course, then we've taken a monumental step forward. And then at the same time, begin to put into place the small market insurance reforms, the other provisions that will help people access the market. And we're not mandating everybody participate at this point. We're not putting together new taxes. We're not saying, putting together financing programs. But what we're saying is let's control the cost. Let's access the market as much as we can with small market insurance reform, et cetera, get as many people in the system as we can, and then determine which ones are left that really do need some type of assistance. With the one exception is that we've identified low-income children and low-income pregnant women as a priority that we should start addressing immediately for preventive care. I hope that explains or answers the question.
I heard you before address, that how many people were involved. Does anybody really trace where our health care dollar goes to see exactly what can be cut out to bring the health care costs down? A lot of people say it's excessive, but they don't say why. Follow the dollars and see where they wind up to see what can be cut out or what will make them more productive. I've never heard anybody say what they think they can do to make the health care system either more productive or less costly compared to inflation, except, those general figures that doesn't cut anybody out or doesn't make anybody make less money out of it.
Well, we don't have a specific answer to that either, but that's one of the areas of data gathering that's got to go on in the initial phase of this program. But it's clear to me that, and we've looked at excess capacity. If you overbuild facilities, that has an impact on the total health care dollar. Utilization does. If people overutilize the health care services, that's volume, and that's going to drive up total health care expenditures. Of course, there's also things that we like that bring about increases. New technology, improvements in technology. I mean, technologically, if I got that term right.
Close enough.
We've got a good system, right? I mean, and people come from other countries to ours. But maybe Joe has a further reference. Yeah.
Well, that's part of the problem in itself. We, particularly in Alaska, have got this Marcus Welby syndrome, where we've seen on TV that there are wonderful advances that have been made, and we can cure darn near anything. And we have kind of a blank check approach up here. Full speed ahead, no matter what the cost, and let's go out and have all these things done, no matter what it costs. And so it's been estimated that anywhere from 30 to 50% of the medical services and supplies that are administered are unnecessary.
Let me add just one other thing, too. There are administrative costs associated with health care, where there may be, I think, coming out of this authority commission, to try to simplify the process, reduce the paperwork.
Oh, yeah, I agree with you, especially the idea of electronic claims processing, where you can go in and it can all be done over the phone or the computer, getting rid of the paperwork. It's more efficiency.
Okay, our next caller is from Anchorage again. Anchorage, good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. This is Jim Sykes calling. As was pointed out earlier by one of the Green Party members, we've been raising this issue for a couple of years now, and I would like to have Senator Duncan comment on a couple of things. First off, SB 254 a couple of years ago looked like it was going to establish a pool for basically municipal, school district, and state employees. And we had proposed to open that up to all Alaskans. I kind of wonder what happened to that concept. And I think that I really appreciate the comments of the insurance person who's speaking this morning, because there are a multitude of problems. But I think we must be honest and realize that insurance companies are money changers. They don't really care what costs where costs go, because they might get some complaints about people paying premiums. But face it, they make more money from people who pay higher premiums. So it's not necessarily in their best interest to push hard for reform. But that aside, if we just take small steps, as this appears to be doing, we never reform the entire system, and the system kind of adapts to the changes and just sucks everything down the drain. We still have to address these ideas of long-term care, which I haven't heard anybody address, and I'm glad to hear that preventive medicine is a priority, because that's what will solve things down the road. But the problem that we have is we don't have affordable health insurance. How does the task force, and indeed the bills now moving through the legislature, create universal access health care for those who need it?
Okay. Senator?
Well, Jim, that's a good question, and I'm going to try to go back through it again, because I think it does it. And I would disagree with you on one step, that these are just very small changes that we're proposing. I've got to say that I think the idea of a global spending limit, if we get that into place, is a tremendous step forward. It's being talked about on a national level. It's never been able to be done. Other states are talking about it. The people that I've talked to on a national level believe that if the state of Alaska did global spending limits, we have taken a tremendous step forward, one that hasn't been achievable elsewhere, and it goes a long ways towards helping contain health care costs. Let me go back to 254, which was 2 years ago, about pooling of public employees into one large person group. That was the idea then, and it's still the idea now, but we don't specify which groups will be pooled together, but we give direct authority to this commission to create the pools necessary in order to achieve savings in procurement of insurance and in order to provide access to the great number of uninsured people who are presently out there. How does this bring about universal care? It doesn't do it overnight, but it will in the long term, and we hope within 3 or 4 or 5 years get us to that point. The first thing it does is it does control health care expenditures in the state of Alaska. We've got to bring that under control from the 15% to 20% a year down to CPI increases, consumer price index increases. That's one part of the equation. As you control cost, and you've also got to provide access. If you do access first, you don't do anything except continue to drive the cost up. So you've got to provide the control first, then the access. And we're providing the access, proposing we provide the access through several different things. Small market insurance reform, by creating, giving this authority the ability to create pools, and then by initially saying, let's get some of the ones we know are going to need assistance, let's get them into the program right away. The low-income children and pregnant women and high-risk individuals. Get them into the system right away. The other number of people we have to subsidize or assist, we don't know, but we will know after we reform the system and after the 38 to 40,000 people who are out there who can help themselves get into the system. We'll finally know how many we have left. We have another 40,000 people, and we'll have to devise at that point some type of a subsidy program or assistance program. So the bottom line of the principles of this task force was to get to universal access. That's where we're heading. I wish we could have it done by July 1st of this year for universal access. It's not possible. But if we do this, we've taken some tremendous steps forward, I believe.
Okay. Senator, one point that has come up, and this was a question I believe that the task force itself raised, and I never heard an answer at the meetings that I went to. The cost of all of this to the state, has that really been determined yet, what Alaska is going to pay, or is this...
Well, the cost of major health care reform has not really been determined, but what has been determined is the cost of not doing it. I mean, the bottom line is the cost of not reforming the system means the $1.5 billion that we spent in 1989 becomes $10 billion in the year 2000. I think it's going to cost some money to do it. It's going to cost some money to put together the authority and to bring in the expertise you need to do global budgeting and to put together the pooling arrangements. It's going to cost some money to access low-income people. It may cost some money to even access high-risk individuals, but no one knows for sure what that will be. But even if it's $1 million a year, I got to tell you, I think it's worthwhile making that kind of an expenditure, even in declining revenues, if you're going to save $7 billion between now and the year 2000. So I really turn the question around. It's not what's going to cost if we do it. It's what's going to cost if we don't do it. And how many people in the state by the year 2000, 25% will be without health coverage.
It's a lot. Noticeable.
Everyone's looking at me. Well, you know, we disagree on some areas of this as far as the way the senator's got his figures and it's kind of a simplistic approach on numbers and things like that. We really don't think you're going to be spending that kind of money in the year 2000, although it will go up quite a bit. Other than that, we're pretty much in agreement. But it is going to cost some real big bucks, and we're back to the philosophical question of, is this something that we need and who's going to pay for it?
Okay. Our next caller from Kenny Lake. Good morning. You're on the air.
Oh, good morning. I'm Sam Lightwood. I've been in Alaska for a long time, and I'm very glad you're working on this problem. And know that you're considering how it works in other places. I've heard lots of good words about the Swedish system. Now, we seem to be considering cost consideration a great deal. I'm aware of what the school district here pays. It's about $6,000 a year per employee to provide health insurance. There's no way a small business or low-income people can begin to have health insurance that costs that much. I have been an employer from time to time, and I have paid anywhere from about $1,000 a month to $2,000 a month. And when you would look at how are they supposed to buy health insurance care. Now, in our state, we already have several health care systems. There's the Native Health Care System and the Veterans Administration Hospital Systems. And has there been any comparison of the cost of services delivered by these systems to the private insurance payments? And while you have used the figure of 15% with no health insurance, I might turn around and say, how many people are covered? I would hazard only 60%. Because there's natives and veterans who are not under this consideration.
Okay, Mr. Lightwood, I want to just as a moment here ask Joe this idea of perhaps $6,000 a year per employee is this something that is that possible? Is that what some employers could be paying for a small group of policy right now?
It's a possibility with a very. It depends how many. People are involved, and if there's medical underwriting and high-risk people and things like that. But on the average, you take any kind of a group that has any kind of what they experience rating and things like that, and you're probably talking about $2,700 to $3,200 a year per employee would be what the average should be.
Okay. And those are factors that nobody really thinks about that because the employee says, well, I'm taking home X amount of money per month, and doesn't think about the insurance cost.
Sure, that's what we call your second paycheck.
Yes, that's right.
That's what the employee doesn't have to pay taxes on. That's provided for him, and it's a pretty big item.
Okay. Senator, his other question involved the veterans groups, the native groups. How has the task force taken those into consideration?
Well, we've tried to look at that, and let me say, probably there is coverage for natives to some extent in the state, but they would be considered the underinsured population. That's really, and when you take them out of the uninsured population, our figures indicate it drops it from 90,000 to 76,000, somewhere in that neighborhood. But any federal expenditures in the state do impact the cost of health care. And we're trying to look at how we have a hard time controlling those federal expenditures. We're trying to look how that fits into the whole mix so that we minimize that impact. But when they build a new hospital, for example, a native hospital or a federal hospital, a veterans hospital in the state, that's more capacity, and that has an impact on health care expenditures in the state and health care costs.
Okay. Our next caller, and probably our last one, we've just got a couple of minutes left. Caller from Anchorage, do you have a brief question you could ask?
Yes, my name is Tony Walker. I was wondering, Title II of the Alaska Statutes and Title 17 allow the state to impose landing fees on aircraft. And this also includes lifeguard aircraft, which are transporting personnel, people from the bush, you know, Alaskan residents and all, back to hospitals here in Anchorage. And I would think that would be a way that the state could help reduce health care is by not imposing landing fees on bona fide lifeguard flights.
That's an interesting point. Does the state really sometimes get an increase
health care, and that's an example of where a state program has increased in health care costs.
You know, we've never looked at that as part of the health care expenditures, I guess. I mean, I guess it could, you know, indirectly be increasing, but we've never looked at that topic or that title. We've discussed landing fees to a great extent in the state legislature as we look at revenues and where we're going to support rural airports, but we've never tied it into the health care situation.
You know, that is a big deal around here because we're unique in our location, and particularly in southeastern Alaska, where we do a lot of medevacs and that sort of thing. And of course, it's a local airport here. It's not a state airport. But on a medevac situation, that's an $8,000 airplane ride to Seattle. They bring in a little Learjet and a couple of pilots and a nurse to go along with, and they charge you everything. They charge you a flat $5,000 fee, plus fuel both ways, plus cruise meals and everything else like that. So the landing fee is probably inconsequential when it comes to the total bill, but it's part of the big picture.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We just got about less than a minute here, right before the show is over. I wanted to ask you, where is the legislation right now, and what sort of pace are we going to be seeing it moving in the last 55 days here of the session?
Well, there's a number of bills around, and probably five or six different pieces of legislation that will incorporate the components of this plan, of these recommendations. Right now, primarily, they're either in the Senate Health, Education, Social Services Committee or the Light Committee on the House side, and they still have a couple of committees to go. But I'm meeting with the chair of that committee tomorrow, and it's my goal to get the fire lit underneath this legislation, and I think individual members will do the same, and hopefully we can get a big part of it through this session.
Thank you a lot. Thank you, Joe Hyacin from the insurance industry here in Juneau. Also, thank you, Senator Jim Duncan. We've been talking health insurance. Thanks also to Jeff Brown, who engineered the show, John Greeley, who produced this morning, and to the staff of KTOO-FM in Juneau for their help. For the Alaska Public Radio Network, I'm Dave Donaldson. Good day.